Every year, except for the last couple of years, there was a man by the name of Barry Lynn, who every year around the election cycle, especially presidential elections, sent out this letter, and it was coming from Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. And of course, he was antagonistic toward us and warned us, you better not say anything politically, because if you do, we'll come after you. Now, I remember the first couple of times I got that when I was in Klamath Falls, I was a little intimidated by it at first, but then I started thinking, well, who are you? Well, they understood the First Amendment to mean that we have to keep quiet, and especially preachers, that's the ones that they target, you can't say anything politically. It's forbidden by the First Amendment. And I'm like, no, it's not. So every year when we started getting it, I would... here, when I moved here, I get it and I just throw the trash, because he's not a government person. Even if he was, that still wouldn't stop me from saying things politically. So anyways, this is the last lesson that I want to give on lessons that I've been using from this book, 10 Tortured Words. I'm only giving you part of it. You can tell it's a good thick book, and I recommend it to you, and I recommend it to you again. If you don't like to have books like this in hand, you can buy the e-book for $2.99. I think I paid... I think that says $25.99 for that. You wouldn't pay that now because you'd probably find it used. But I highly recommend it, and if you read it, you'll see how much I left out. It's really good. But the part that I want to give to you tonight, and it's prompted by people like this Barry Lynn that I just told you about, are just quotes. I'm going to give 20 different quotes from America's founders. Before I do that, I want to give you three different quotes from this author here, Stephen Mansfield, and then I want to read to you what he says about using quotes. So first of all, he said this. We live in an age of faith, and yet an age when faith is feared. And I think he's right. People, especially on the secular side, fear you because of your faith. I don't know if they think you're going to go out and kill people or what it is, but they fear you. He continued, we live at a time when men yearn to believe and yet doubt those who do. We live in a day when religion lifts men to greatness but also makes them vicious and hard. When a vision of God makes nations noble, but also leads to unspeakable horror. And of course, right here, he's using the word religion to mean more than just Christianity. And you can tell that that would include things like terrorist acts that we've seen happen against our nation almost 20 years ago. Again, he says, what distinguishes the crisis of faith in our day, though, is that they are often rooted more in fear of faith than in lack of faith. Earlier generations who moved away from traditional faith simply chose not to believe. They did not fear religion. They quietly concluded that religion wasn't true. We dare to believe religion might be true, but fear the consequences. And again, I think I see his point. I mentioned to you that back in the 1950s, the Jehovah's Witnesses were being forced, the kids, in school to stand and place their hands over their hearts and say the Pledge of Allegiance. So they filed a lawsuit and won in that their children don't have to say the Pledge of Allegiance. They have their reasons for doing that. I don't agree with them, but that's fine. But the difference in what we're dealing with today is if I don't like doing it, you're not going to do it either. And the Jehovah's Witnesses didn't do that. So as much as I disagree with them on just about everything, I at least respected them for that. But for the atheists and the secularists and the others who are saying, well, I don't believe, therefore you shouldn't, or it should be cut off from you, I just think they're wrong-headed in what they're saying and doing. Again, Stephen Mansfield also said, our generation has been given good reason to suspect faith. After all, Feuerbach told us that man created God and not the other way around. Freud told us that God is a projection of man's own psychology. Marx told us that religion is like opium. And Nietzsche told us there is no God, but that in his absence, the state will do just fine. That's why Marxism is actually growing in the United States of America, which just blows my mind. But it shouldn't. I shouldn't be surprised. The more you push God away, the state's going to take place of God. And think about everything that we want the state to do in our lives. It's like it's God. And then his last sentence there. This was all before various New Age religions told us that we are God. So here we've got all these people of great influence who are telling us, here's all these different ideas about God, and it makes people suspect, and they think, why even believe in the first place? So before I introduce these quotes, let me just read to you from Stephen Mansfield and what he says about using quotes, because I think it's good. He said this, "The debate over the religious vision of the American founders often descends into a battle of quotes. Alone, of course, quotes prove little. Men change throughout their lives. Having opinions in youth, they abandon with age. For example, there was a period in Abraham Lincoln's life where he was an atheist. And so I have seen where atheists will say, they'll put a picture of faces, like a collage, of great atheists of the past. And one of them that they'll stick in there is Abraham Lincoln. But as a whole, he was not an atheist, and he abandoned that view, and all you got to do is read some of his speeches that he gave while he was president. So continuing. Men also say one thing in private correspondence and do quite another while in public office. It is dangerous to assume that one quote captures the entire thinking of a man or a generation. That said, it has become a common assumption in our time that the founding fathers were personally religious but wished their government to be secular. Nothing could be further from the truth. The quotes below, and they'll be the ones I'm going to give you, held up against the broader material in this book, provide compelling evidence that the founding generation understood, as they wrote in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, that religion is necessary to good government. And all these quotes that I'm going to give you, most of the names will be familiar to you. The ones I think are not familiar, I'll tell you who they were. But you're going to see how they thought the government will turn into something bad if you silence religion. Government needs religion, and in particular, they're thinking of the Christian religion. So, in my opinion, these quotes show why our founding fathers wrote the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's what the title of this book is based on, those 10 tortured words, how they've been turned around. But rather, they wanted to protect religion and not suppress it, as the rest of the religion part of the First Amendment says, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So they shouldn't be doing anything to keep us or kids in school or wherever it is from practicing their religion. All right, here we go. America's first vice president and second president, John Adams, said, "Statesmen, my dear sir, may plan and speculate for liberty, but it is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand." And I think if you just consider what the scriptures teach, that would be true. Galatians chapter 5, we're free, but we're free by the law of Christ. I know to a lot of people that sounds contradictory. Freedom means no law. But no, it's actually law that gives us freedom. John Adams again. "Religion and virtue are the only foundations, not only of republicanism and of all free government, but of social felicity under all governments and in all combinations of human society." Now there he was not talking about the Republican Party, because it wasn't in existence yet, but rather he's just talking about our form of government, which is representative. That's what Republican type of government is. We elect representatives, and they work for us, in this case, Washington, D.C. The third quote from Adams. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. And I think he's right. When you see what has gone on in the past several decades and how people have used our Constitution, you'll see exactly what he's talking about. It's like he knew what would happen. I think it's because he knew what the Scriptures teach. The Scriptures teach what our tendency is, how we have a tendency to digress if we are not guided by truth and Scripture, and how we have a tendency just to go down more and more and more, and we'll use things like the Constitution. For example, it's amazing to me that these same people will seek to quiet us, thinking the First Amendment makes us quiet, but they think the same First Amendment, later in the amendment, gives pornography just all the freedom it wants to have. But if you remember the preamble of the Constitution, it says that this has been given, we're writing this for the general welfare of the citizens. And how does pornography promote the welfare of, well, I was going to say of American citizens, but of any citizen anywhere in the world? Whereas religion, I think, definitely does. The next quote from John Adams' son, John Quincy Adams, who also served as president, he said, "From the day of the Declaration, they, the American people, were bound by the laws of God, which they all, and by the laws of the gospel, which they nearly all, acknowledged as the rules of their conduct." So he's saying, yeah, sure, there were some who didn't want to live by it, but as a whole, the American people back in those days understood that we're to be guided by God's word, and that's what they wanted, and they understood how it would give us good government, and it did. And he says that started clear from the Declaration. And as you recall, I have told you that actually when you look at the top of the Declaration, the actual document, it doesn't say the Declaration of Independence, although even the founders will call it the Declaration of Independence. It just says the unanimous declaration of the 13 colonies or something like that, or the United States of America. And then they first state their independence, their desire to be independent from Great Britain, then their 27 reasons why, and then the second declaration, that is that they're going to rely upon divine providence. So from that time forward, they've been saying, we're not in competition with religion, we're not here to suppress it, we're here to give it all the freedom that it needs. And our Constitution was written the same way, which I'll cover at another time. Elias Boudinot, who was a delegate at the Continental Congress, that's the one that gave us the Constitution, he was a congressman and director of the United States Mint. He said, "Our country should be preserved from the dreadful evil of becoming enemies to the religion of the gospel, which I have no doubt, but would be the introduction of the dissolution of government and the bonds of civil society." And one thing I can do is say, look at 2020 and the rioting and looting that has gone on. These guys didn't know when that would happen, but they could tell, here's what human behavior is like, here's what we've learned from history, and here's what the Bible says. Sooner or later, if you just remove religion out of the way, you remove the gospel in particular, and keep it away from the citizens of a nation, they are going to descend into chaos. And here we have it. Charles Carroll, who was a signer of the Declaration and a senator, he said, "Without morals, a republic cannot subsist any length of time. They, therefore, who are decrying the Christian religion, whose morality is so sublime and pure, which denounces against the wicked the eternal misery and ensures to the good eternal happiness, are undermining the solid foundations of morals, the best security for the duration of free governments." So in other words, already at that time, there's some people who are saying that we don't want religion. We don't want it in our society. And he's saying, look, if you do that, it's going to collapse. It won't last. Samuel Chase, who was also a signer of the Declaration and a Supreme Court Associate Justice, said, religion is of general and public concern, and on its support depend in great measure the peace and good order of government, the safety and happiness of the people. By our own form of government, the Christian religion is the established religion, and all sects and denominations of Christians are placed upon the same equal footing and are equally entitled to protection in their religious liberty. Now, especially his first sentence there, I don't know if he intended to allude to 1 Timothy 2 or not, but when I read that, just 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 7 jumps out at me. And the last three sermons that I did on this topic, I had the reader before the sermon read from 1 Timothy 2. And that's where, again, Paul told us that we need to be praying for our governmental leaders and making intercession for them so that they will create a situation in our nation where we can live in all godliness and reverence, in peace and harmony. And he goes on to explain why that is, so that religion will have the freedom that it needs. And I urged you to take 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 7, and make it your own prayer. Adopt it or adapt it, whatever way you need to. But would you please pray 1 Timothy 2? Often, our nation needs it. Your fellow Americans need it. Your children and your grandchildren need it. And you'll recognize this guy, Benjamin Franklin. History will also afford frequent opportunities of showing the necessity of a public religion from its usefulness to the public. So in other words, when we make ourselves, when the church makes itself useful to the public, then people will see how necessary it is to have it. They shouldn't see us as a corrupting influence or something that promotes evil or bad in any way, but that we do good things. And if we're taken away, good will cease and bad will increase. Again from Mr. Franklin. Whoever shall introduce into public affairs the principles of primitive Christianity will change the face of the world. There have been other nations, especially in Europe, that have been friendly to Christianity, although their particular denomination that was the state church. Never has there been a nation like the United States of America where Christianity, all its sects and denominations, has total freedom. They're on equal footing because not one is made the prominent church, made into the state church. So he says, when you have people who just introduce primitive Christianity in particular, then that nation is going to change the world. And has the United States of America changed the world? If you know anything about history, you cannot deny that it has. That's why people are breaking down our door. That's why they're sneaking in to get here. And that has come about because of the kind of government that Bible-believing men put into place. Now, what I think is interesting is when he wrote this, or said this, at that time, there's a movement in America that says, let's bypass all denominations and go back to the Bible. And it was after he was gone when it really came to fruition, we know as the Restoration Movement. And we're part of that. Denominationalism has hurt the cause of Christ. And so we just need to go back to primitive Christianity, just the way Benjamin Franklin said. And by the way, he had a relative, I don't remember if he was a nephew or who he was, carried his same name, Benjamin Franklin, who was a preacher in the church. In the Church of Christ in the 1900s or 19th century. And he was a great preacher. I've read some of his stuff, and wow, it's his uncle or whoever they were from each other. he gets all the glory. You don't hear about this other one, but this his relative really said some good stuff. So he kind of picked up on what his older family relative had to say, and good things have come from that. All right. John Jay, who was the first Chief Justice of the United States of America, said, "No human society has ever been able to maintain both order and freedom, both cohesiveness and liberty, apart from the moral precepts of the Christian religion applied and accepted by all the classes. Should our republic ever forget this fundamental precept of governance, men are certain to shed their responsibilities for licentiousness, and this great experiment will surely then be doomed." And again, his words read almost like a prophet. Like he could see what would happen, and it's happening before our very eyes. But the point being that all of these men so far, and I've got more to go, show that when they gave us the government that we have, it was never their impression to set up a government that would suppress religion and guarantee a secular society. Can you see them doing that with the way they're expressing themselves here? And then this one, Thomas Jefferson said, and this one's powerful. This is one of the most powerful quotes in all these ones that I'm giving you. "God who gave us life gave us liberty. And can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God? That they are not to be violated but with his wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever." Oh, did I? Okay, there you go. Sorry about that. I guess I advanced it too. So that should be the right one. Okay, so you can look at it as I continue to talk there. Thomas Jefferson new society like these other men, but also we have a tendency to think that everything in the past in America was always good and always religious, and that's not necessarily the case. In fact, in the days leading up to the Revolution, religion was at a low. It was not popular. Things were going well. When things are going well for people, they have a tendency to not see their need for religion or for faith. So he's like, we need to consider how we're living. And so there have been a couple of what are known as great awakenings in America, where we got very low in religion, where church attendance was almost non-existent. And then usually some preachers came along and got the people fired up and got them back to where they needed to be. Okay, so now we'll go to that. Let's see, that's not... Okay, I see what I did. I skipped it on my page. Okay, I didn't advance it twice up there. Okay, so the other one that he said was, "The Christian religion, when divested of the rags in which they have enveloped it, and brought to the original purity and simplicity of its benevolent institutor, is a religion of all others most friendly to liberty." And again, you can see in his mind, if you know anything about the Restoration Movement, how this was kind of permeating in our society. We need to get rid of all denominational creeds and all that kind of stuff and just go back to the original. Let's just go back to what the institutor, Jesus Christ, gave to the world. Let's cast aside everything else, divorce ourselves from all those other things, and go back to the source, the Scriptures. And on that, I think you and I have to agree with him. So now we go to James Madison. And he said, "Religion is the basis and foundation of government." And again, "The belief in a God all-powerful, wise, and good is essential to the moral order of the world and to the happiness of man." And a third quote from him. "It is the duty of every man to render to the Creator such homage before any man can be considered as a member of civil society. He must be considered as a subject of the governor of the universe. Now, he was not here proposing that, you know what, before we let anyone be a citizen of the United States, we need to give them a test and see whether or not they're willing to submit themselves to the God of heaven or to follow Jesus Christ. But he is arguing that if you want to contribute to a civil society, if you want our society to have peace and harmony, the best thing you can do is to acknowledge the God of heaven. And on that, I think we would all agree that he was absolutely right. John Marshall said, "The American population is entirely Christian, and with us, Christianity and religion are identified. It would be strange indeed if, with such a people, our institutions did not presuppose Christianity and did not often refer to it and exhibit relations with it." And to me, that does not sound like that they intended for the government or for the Constitution to be antagonistic toward religion. That was not their thoughts at all. Benjamin Rush, who was a signer of the Declaration and a Surgeon General, at least for the military, "It is foreign to my purpose to hint at the arguments which establish the truth of Christian religion. My only business is to declare that all its doctrines and precepts are calculated to promote the happiness of society and the safety and well-being of civil government." And isn't that true? I mean, think about what you read in the Bible, in particular the New Testament. Aren't all those things calculated in such a way that it's going to improve our relationships? We're going to be better people. We're going to be better neighbors. We're going to be better citizens of our country. And you have all those things, and then the government grows out of that, and the government then will be the same way. And I think I have to agree with him on that one also. Another quote from Benjamin Rush. "I have always considered Christianity as the strong ground of republicanism. The spirit is opposed not only to the splendor, but even to the very forms of monarchy. And many of its precepts have their objects, republican liberty and equality, as well as simplicity, integrity, and economy in government. It is only necessary for republicanism to ally itself to the Christian religion to overturn all the corrupted political and religious institutions in the world." Now, I know some of these things are mouthfuls, and with some of these quotes, they're not exactly talking the way we would today. But I think you can see the general idea that Christianity, Benjamin Rush believed, would contribute to the best government in the world. Not just here, of course, but anywhere. And then finally, two more quotes from a guy you'll recognize, George Washington. "True religion affords to government its surest support." That's why I had Nash read Romans chapter 13. Because Paul was writing to Christians in Rome, where a corrupt, powerful empire was seated, and he was telling the brethren there to submit themselves to the government. Of course, there's the exception if the government's asking you to do something you shouldn't be doing. But other than that, give it your full support, he said. Pay your taxes. Give honor to whom honor is due. And so forth. Obey them is what he said. And that's what George Washington is arguing here. He knew Romans 13. I'm sure if he was here today, he could just quote it to us. So he's telling us again that if you want to have a good religion, you want one that's going to last and one that's going to promote peace, then you need to have religion. And the final quote is this one here. "Religion and morality are the essential pillars of civil society." How can we possibly disagree with that? I'd like you to open your Bibles now to Romans chapter 1, and I want to show you something from here that I think influenced all of these men. They read this, they knew the scriptures to be true, and so as they're forming our government, they said, here's why we need to make sure that we protect religion. Not that we take one denomination and make it the state church, but we need to have freedom of religion here. Romans 1:18 says, that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And here's why. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. And then he explains that since the time of creation, you can tell, men have been able to discern that there is a God, that he has great intellectual powers, and that he has massive power to be able to create everything. But they did not glorify him as God, verse 21. They didn't give him thanks. And so as a result, the end of verse 21, they became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts are darkened. They end up professing themselves to be wise, but they become fools in the process, verse 22. Therefore, verse 24, God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. And for our society today, I think the lie that has been promoted the most, and it's what I was going to originally address this morning, and I'll address it next Lord's Day, Lord willing, is that of evolution. I think evolution and its conquering of every institution in America has really changed everything about the nation we love. Paul continued, for this reason, you know, because they gave up on God, didn't want to glorify him or give him thanks, God gave them up to vile passions, and he talked about homosexuality. Verse 28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. And then he proceeds to list those things. So again, these founding fathers, that whole generation, they knew these truths. And so that's why they put in that government to ensure that we could do what we're doing right now, and all our doors are unlocked. We have big, gigantic windows out there in the foyer. Lights are all on, and nobody has any fear. The history of the kings of Israel and Judah, I think, also prove the founders correct. When they abandoned belief in God, what happened to both Israel and Judah? They descended. The history of every nation proves the correctness of the founding fathers, who knew history and who knew the Bible. However, we, I believe, have been content to let secularists run our government, run our schools, especially the universities, run our media, run everything in our nation. But it's time for us to take action, and I just want to propose two things to you. One which I've already mentioned in another sermon, and I mentioned earlier in this sermon, and that's prayer. Please be relentless with God in prayer about our nation based on 1 Timothy 2. Would you do that, please? And then number two, I believe that we need to encourage our children to seek careers which will promote good in America. We have a tendency to think, I want you just to get a job where you get make a lot of money, or make a job that makes you feel good, or just do what you want. And shouldn't we be telling them, do what the Lord wants you to do? We want them to follow Christ. Okay, well, what does the Lord want you to do? I realize most of us are already in our careers, but our children are not. They can still decide. So encourage them. Get a career that either they serve the church or they serve their country, or they do something where they're going to be able to do good things. And I'm not saying that if you're not in any of those areas, if you're not in government or whatever, that you're not any good to our nation. I don't mean that at all. God puts us in all levels of society through all different kinds of occupations and everything. But I'm just saying, I would like us to see more promotion of our children getting into positions of influence. Our nation needs it. Our future generations need it. The church needs it. So can you do that, please? If a child is not, what's the word I'm looking for? It'll come to me later at 3 o'clock this morning. I'll call you all and let you know. But aptitude, there it is. I know that not everyone's aptitude is toward these things that I'm talking about. We all have an aptitude to do something. And whatever it is, do it with your might and glorify God in your job, would you? And God will use you. He's probably already using you whether you realize it or not. Okay, so now we want to offer an invitation song, and if you have a need, something that you'd like us to pray for you on your behalf, please come forward now as we stand and sing.